Okay, welcome back to another episode of Security Ledger Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts. I'm the editor-in-chief at Security Ledger, and we are very pleased today to have with us Chris Walcott, who is the Chief Security Officer at Direct Defense. Chris, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me, Paul.
I think it's our first time having you on the show, and I'm thrilled to have you. For listeners, viewers who aren't familiar with Direct Defense, could you just give us an idea of what Direct Defense does?
Absolutely. We are a full-service cybersecurity organization. We have pillars that support penetration and application security testing. We are an MSSP. We do SIM compliance work. And we have a specialty practice called Connected Systems, which is focused around the OT, SCADA, IoT world, and hardware and device testing.
Again, your chief security officer, you're kind of, you know, there's so many interesting journeys and paths to cybersecurity. What is your background and how did you find your path to the cybersecurity industry?
So interestingly enough, and probably like some of our compatriots, I started on a help desk. So I started on the energy commodities trading help desk for a Fortune 200 energy firm. Very fast paced, no room for downtime. Everything was focused on uptime. You know, trading losses could total into the millions of dollars per minute. But that was a great place to learn because I went from there.
High stakes.
Yeah. But I learned, you know, I learned sysadmin, I learned application packaging, I learned network engineering. And then I was interested in network. And so I took that path, network engineering, network architecture. And then somewhere along the way through a variety of projects, I ended up as the head of IT for power generation. So we had more than 30 plants around North America, including 3 nuclear plants. And was in that role when the NERC SIP regulations came out, which was the first real foray into cybersecurity regulation for critical infrastructure in the US. So that was the 2006 era. In that role, I was helping to put together policy and procedure for cybersecurity for these plants and helping to try to put a security wrapper around old infrastructure. I went from there to SunGuard, spent some time there helping run threat and vulnerability management, you know, understanding more in the vulnerability space and then some breach work, and then spent 7 years at Black & Veatch, and then I've been with Direct Defense for almost 7 years.
I mean, a really interesting journey, and you were sort of there when, like you said, when NERC SIP came through. Prior to that, there wasn't much of a conversation in critical infrastructure around cybersecurity. It was mostly kind of companies were left to their own devices, more or less.
Correct.
Yeah.
Except the nuclear world, but yes.
Right. How did you see the conversation evolve around cyber risk from, hey, you know, NERC SIP, we got to kind of check our boxes and be compliant to, oh, you know, actually, no, this is an existential risk for us as an organization?
You know, I think that migration really kind of flowed from a need for resilience. And so the focus on resilience originally was critical infrastructure systems, and this is also true of manufacturing because they use the same type of products for control under the hood, really was focused around uptime. So a programmable logic controller that might start or stop a breaker in the power grid or might turn or on or off a combustion turbine in a power plant is the same one that might start or stop a conveyor or an oven or a metal press in manufacturing. And they're built to withstand heat and vibration and last 20 years. There's no component in the IT world that's really built or designed that way. They all sort of have this 3 to 5, maybe 7 year at a stretch life cycle. And so the focus went from, we have this need for resilience and uptime. How do we move into being able to protect these things with an understanding that we can't do it the way we would normally? You can't put antivirus on a PLC. You can't use normal monitoring tools because the devices in those environments don't use the same communications protocols. Those monitoring platforms, even the best of them that have made an effort to push into that space, that's not really something natively that they're going to understand. So in the very early days, there were a few companies that made a push into the space from the vendor side. I'm thinking Industrial Defender, which then got sold and resold a couple of times around. And originally they were product and then they were service. But what has happened over the years is there's been more of a spotlight. And so it started with an experiment that was done at Idaho National Labs in 2008 called the Aurora experiment.
Yep.
If you haven't seen it, there's a fun video on YouTube. I'm sure you have. Yeah, famous, right?
Shows this generator kind of basically shaking itself apart.
Self-destructing, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Some commands that were normal commands, but sort of out of sequence were sent through to it remotely by some people at INL. That started the awareness. The NERC SIP, and frankly, you even go back a little bit further in the resilience discussions to the blackout in 2003. And that got everybody thinking, because that impacted such a large percentage of the population, right? Northeast, that everybody started to go, oh, well, what if somebody did this on purpose? You know, what would that look like? The very first SANS SCADA security conference was in Orlando in 2006. That's where a lot of these discussions started. NERC-CIP had just been put in place.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about it for a couple of years. I had like 12 or 14 power plants that were in the western portion of the U.S. that fell under a regulatory audit body called WEC. And we had volunteered to be sort of a guinea pig for them and go early and pre-audit. And the head of that group at that time was a gentleman named Patrick Miller, who's, you know, still a friend, and actually spoke to him the other day. So we still talk about these things, right?
So one of the things that Direct Defense does, you mentioned you're an MSSP, but you also do security assessments of your customers or clients, pen testing, red teaming, that type of thing. So give me a sense, without naming names, but what are you seeing both in terms of security posture of some of these infrastructure owners? And then on the MSSP side, what are we seeing in terms of threats, attacks, you know, activity? Is it more of the same, or are we seeing real changes just in the, you know, quantity and quality of threats out there facing these types of organizations?
The assessment work probably opens a bit of a Pandora's box depending on the industry, right? So the energy sector has had regulation in place for a long time. Some of the other sectors have made pushes in that direction, water with the America's Water Infrastructure Act and the EPA regulation. Homeland Security through CISA and TSA has made pushes into transportation and pipeline. And I know we're going to talk about some of that stuff. But for the most part, a lot of these organizations are still focused around this kind of hard exterior, hard and crunchy on the outside, soft and chewy in the middle, right? They're focused on uptime, resilience, and allowing data flow where it needs to within that contained space. And the contained space is, you know, it could be a substation or a power plant or a manufacturing facility. And that assessment work a lot of times is driven around trying to help them push towards visibility, because there are now visibility tools that function in the space that allow the system owners to do more with understanding what's going on, establish that baseline so that they know when something's different, they know when something's potentially wrong. The newer tools that have come out understand the protocols and allow for just a deeper level of intelligence. And then add to that, the part of the cross sell for the software vendors is that those tools are also allowing for inventory and maintenance improvements and things that have always been a challenge, right? Those have always been stuck in the world of, well, we've got an Excel spreadsheet. So the clients are really focused a lot of times on network segmentation, because the networks are not set up properly to allow for the visibility, because we still need basically to be able to have inspection choke points for the traffic. We're still in a world of span and tap where we can't go down the path of, I'm going to put an agent on this thing. You're not going to do that with a PLC. There's not a lot of Windows and Linux operating system computers in those environments. It's a lot of real-time operating system stuff.
And that's been an issue for a couple decades, right? Which is IT security community wants to come in and talk to you about monitoring and detection and so on. Yeah. But OT folks are like, you don't really speak our language. Like you can't manage any of these protocols that our equipment uses. And your stuff was designed to work on totally different type of device, and it's going to completely brick this device. So End of the conversation, really, basically. Although, you know, there are obviously companies now that do specialize around, and we know who they are, but, you know.
Yeah, there are some, and we've partnered with some of them. We try to remain vendor agnostic, but the partnerships have allowed us to have access to training and better understanding of how the tools work. So when we have clients that have one in place or they're considering one of a couple, we can help them make informed decisions. And in some cases, maybe even consider changes in architecture that would allow them to work better. And that's also why the connected systems team at Direct Defense is built the way it is.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of organizations would take an information security practitioner, you know, a white hat penetration tester, and give them training in the OT space, or maybe it's a fun side project and they go and buy some IoT products for home and break them and kind of see how that all works. Everyone in that practice was a practitioner. So we had people who've worked for energy and water utilities, people who've been responsible directly for manufacturing, people who've worked for software companies that make IoT devices work.
Mm-hmm.
So when they come into that environment, there's an easier conversation and a better level of trust off the bat. That customer, and not necessarily the corporate side of the customer that might engage with us directly, But the people that are running the power plants or the substation, the power grid, the water and wastewater, the gas pipeline, the manufacturing plant, when you speak their language and they understand you've done their job, they know that you get how important the uptime is to them. And it focuses that discussion. They also trust a little bit more when you tell them that there are solutions that might work.
Yeah. So getting things, I mean, do you think it impacts actually security outcomes to have folks who again, speak the language, have history, like, you know, do you feel like—
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Because I think there's always a fear that when a third party comes in, that they're there for their own agenda to make money, to find more business, to continue to keep you on the hook to do things. If you have being the person that gets the call at 2 o'clock in the morning because the conveyor system is down or because this power plant tripped offline or because the water SCADA system is not responding, it's a shared pain, right? It's just like anybody who's worked in a NOC or a SOC, who's had a night shift, anybody who's had a help desk, who's gotten the, you know, the page of the call in the middle of the night. When you've been in their shoes, there's that understanding of, okay, you've been where I am. You really understand what I'm concerned about. And theoretically, you're not just going to advise me to do something that doesn't make sense for the system we're trying to protect.
So we've had some really scary, dire sounding warnings in recent months from CISA and others around cyber threats, critical infrastructure. I know CISA in February put out an alert specific to PRC, China's government, getting its hooks into U.S. critical infrastructure with an eye to potentially, you know, very disruptive attacks, presumably as part of some future conflict, whether it's around Taiwan or whatever else. So a couple questions. What are your thoughts on that? Has Direct Defense seen evidence of those types of sophisticated nation state campaigns amongst your critical infrastructure customers? And what is the practical impact of an alert like that, for just in your experience working within this sector? CISA puts out an alert like that. Does it have an impact? Does it actually change kind of behaviors and on the ground? Or is it more just, you know, we're just covering our butt here. You can't say we didn't warn you. And that's basically the point.
You know, I have a lot of respect for what CISA's trying to do. I think that part of the challenge is that they are putting the message out into the world, and the people in the organizations that are really focused on what they're saying and taking the best information they can from all their data sources, including what's put out in those threat briefs and intelligence and things like that. Those are the people in the organizations that are already refocused that way, or the ones that got burned, the ones that have been breached. Getting the message out to the, let's say, the other 80, 85% who either don't feel they have the budget to do anything, don't feel they've got the leadership on board to support what they're trying to accomplish, or maybe just feel that they can fly under the radar. That's the real challenge. How do you get the message to the organizations and to the people that,
right,
you know, they're still focused on their day job. They're focused on their resilience. You know, we talk about the water space a lot. There was a press release that came out and a CISA alert that came out earlier in the year about targeting of specific PLCs. There was a water utility in Pennsylvania, and that one was pseudo state sponsored, but they were targeting specific companies that had ties to a government because of some political turmoil.
I remember it. Yes. The hardware maker was linked to a non-US government entity that
correct. And so this was a state sponsored attack on.
We'll let you guess who that country was, but
right.
Open your news browser and you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
But the focus there is that the water sector in particular is one that has talked about cybersecurity for a long time. I sat in a meeting a few years ago with some engineering firms and a bunch of water utilities and the EPA administrators.
Yeah.
Not long after OWIA was signed, the America's Water Infrastructure Act. And the goal of the water utilities, the larger ones were focused on protecting themselves. The smaller ones were somewhat focused, not entirely, but at least somewhat focused on resilience. But their answer is always, we can run the system manually. We can just disconnect. The only things that they're required to provide to anybody is they have to put water quality reports up, usually to a state level entity. And sometimes that's multiple times a day, but that can be done manually. And then if they are owned by municipal government, then they have to put some sort of operational, you know, we're not wasting money type data out on a website maybe once a month.
Yeah.
And so they were comfortable to say, we could just disconnect and operate manually. The other major difference is that if we compare energy and water sectors, we think, if we compare energy and water sectors in the US, right, the energy sector is mostly owned by merchant energy companies that are for-profit mm-hmm. organizations. A lot of them are publicly traded. Mm-hmm. Because of that, there's a much larger pool of money for them to do things in the cybersecurity area. Yeah. Most of the water utilities are small, municipally owned, and their funding comes directly out of the taxpayer's pocket and really no place else except maybe for some grants. And so they don't have the same pool of resources. So that's been part of the challenge, especially for the medium and smaller ones in that space.
Yeah. I'm on my community's local IT advisory committee. We've got a locally owned electric utility. And so I've seen this up close, which is it all comes down to budget and staffing. And, you know, literally the job of the water utility is to keep the water flowing. Job of the electric utility is to keep the lights on. And some of these kind of fuzzy, you know, cyber threat conversations, you know, just it's hard to get them fired up about them because, you know, again, budget and staffing are limited. And that talent is, I mean, this is kind of where companies like Direct Defense come in, right? That cyber talent is very expensive and hard to come by. So unless you're going
with a... It's an unusual skill set for sure, especially in this OT SCADA space. And, you know, so then part of my responsibility that I take personally is evangelism in this space. So I've been involved with the NERC SIP committees for years and years. I still participate with the SIP 13 Supply Chain Working Group. I participate with the American Water Works Association, which is drinking water only, but they're the main sort of lobbying group around some of this. And they have a cybersecurity director, Dr. Kevin Morley, who's constantly trying to work with the EPA to further the cause of cybersecurity resilience in the water space. And so one of my colleagues and I were involved in the rewrite of their J100 standard, which is a best practice guide, because there is no regulation to enforce it, but it is a best practice guide for cybersecurity that roughly follows the NIST standards. And so there have been pushes in little pockets in the private sector to kind of move in this direction, but that's why we take part in organizations like that. I do webinars for the American Council of Engineering Companies and the Engineering Change Lab, because the engineering firms really play a critical role. If I wanted to attack critical infrastructure, utility critical infrastructure in this country, I wouldn't go after any one utility because no one can take down any more than a small region of anything. But if you go after some of the engineering firms that have done the integration work that has maybe remote access into some of these systems. And so I also make a point of talking
to
them.
That supply chain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really interesting. So Direct Defense has written up, you've done blogging and stuff about some of the work that you do with your customers, and especially with some of your, you know, pen testing and red teaming engagements, mm-hmm. talked about the risk posed by, you know, just social engineering attacks as a first stage in what might be a more sophisticated operation. 60 Minutes just did a story looking at the MGM casino hack out in Vegas. Actually, it wasn't limited to Vegas. That started with a pretty targeted social engineering attack on a privileged, you know, MGM admin. This is just such a fuzzy problem. But what do you see as the fix for that for a critical infrastructure owner, given that, you know, every organization has a layer 8 problem? You know, humans are humans. It's hard to get them to be fully defended against a clever, sophisticated social engineering attack. How do you deal with a squishy problem like that? Because it's not solely a technology problem.
I think part of that is personalizing it for them. If you get them some content like yours, or if you get them an opportunity to sit down and listen to content like mine, right? Where we can really relate to you, you know, we came in one day, that night we physically broke into this small utility. We found a work order for some networking work for the next day from a vendor. We made a photocopy of it. We went to the front desk. We stole some visitor badges. We came back the next morning with hard hats on and those badges and our paperwork and a box of donuts, and they let us right in. And so, and this is a true story, right?
The donuts were key there.
Yeah, they were. We had another one of our testers that found a job listing and applied for the job, was offered an interview, went in person to the interview, and they left him alone to fill out the paperwork. He plugged a device into the network as part of the penetration test, right?
Yeah.
So the human element, when you can personalize it, it allows people to say, you know, that's a funny story. You're going to remember it a lot better than your video that you got from a vendor. They're going to remember it better than the email that they didn't really read that they clicked through. And then when they see something weird, like somebody trying to tailgate into the building that they don't know, they may actually say something. That method of education, I think, is one of the best ones, is that personalization.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back. You had asked the last question, had a couple of parts to it, and we didn't get to one or two of them. Sophisticated threat actors on the state-sponsored side.
Yes.
We have recently worked breaches. We do breach work, both on the IT and the OT side. And we worked a breach a few months ago for a larger client. It absolutely appeared to be a state-sponsored threat actor. And they were very sophisticated. We were working alongside a couple of other larger firms together. And the mechanisms they used were, frankly, impressive. They sent an actual person with a fake ID and enough information into a cellular phone store in a big US city and SIM swapped an IT admin for that organization. And the IT admin figured it out pretty quick and swapped it back. So the same person went into a second store location in the same city that same day and swapped it again. They are getting pretty brazen. The more sophisticated threat actors are willing to go to quite a length to get what they want to get.
They've got operatives on the ground, which we generally don't assume. I mean, we know the Chinese and Russians and so on have spies in this country, but we don't think about them in the context of that type of attack.
Right. And in this particular case, they then contacted the help desk and they got the help desk to break one of their own protocols through some social engineering. But then there also was something of a broken process in the midst there, right? So in my personal opinion, we also do virtual CISO services. I'm virtual CISO for a couple of our clients. Your help desk level one staff should not be able to reset admin credentials. If you want to reset admin credentials, get someone who knows the person, get them on a video call with that person, and then reset their credentials.
Right.
Just some basic protocols, some basic cyber hygiene stuff. Those are the kinds of things that don't cost any money. But if you make the mistake, then they cost you your company.
Right. Making sure all your employees or your valued or highly privileged employees have PINs set up on their mobile phones, right? So you can't just SIM swap, right? Without
Exactly. Yeah. And so one of the things that we helped them with in the aftermath was send a message to all your employees. This should be part of your annual training. There is SIM swap prevention offered by all the major cell phone carriers. Go down that path. Take that extra step.
So one of the things that I think, you know, we're really starting to wrestle with is, of course, supply chain risk. You know, every organization is addressing, and we saw this most recently with the, you know, Pulse Secure Avanti disclosure, where you had, you know, security hardware running an 11-year-old open source operating system that was 4 years end of life, but had encrypted software updates. So nobody it was kind of a black box. It wasn't easy to reverse engineer those binaries and figure that out, and ended up having exploitable vulnerabilities that were taken advantage of by a nation state actor. That just encapsulates really nicely the sort of what's in the sausage question that so many organizations are wrestling with. I would assume this is true in the OT space and critical infrastructure space as well, that
it's
everybody's sort
true.
Of, yeah, looking at
it's
their,
very true.
Yeah, and saying, gosh, what are we running here? Especially some of these systems are quite old. Do you see any like initiatives or actions to address that supply chain risk? Or is that just kind of the elephant in the living room and folks are trying to figure out how to even get around it?
My marketing people are going to kill me for this, but it's one of my favorite taglines. I coined a phrase for a speaking engagement in 2017. I start out with, how well do you think you should know your vendor before you let them into your environment? Do you just let them take you to lunch? Do you maybe have a couple of dinners? Do you find out anything about them? Because if you're not careful, you're going to contract a vendor-transmitted disease.
That's right.
We really want to avoid those VTDs. And this guides some of the work that I've done with
I'm seeing connections to other areas of our lives. Yeah, right. It's the same concept, right?
Right. So this is the concept of supply chain risk, really in a nutshell. You do want to know that they have done some security testing. If you're buying hardware, ask them. There's a few, there aren't a lot, but there's now a few cybersecurity hardware certifications, right? Mm-hmm. So IEC 62443, which is also ISA 99, is out there. UL 2941 is sort of on the process of being wrapped up. And these are things that we've helped some of our clients with, right? We got the first battery storage system, think a shipping container full of batteries that's utilized to store energy from like a solar field or a wind farm.
Right.
When the lights, you know, when the sun's up and the wind's blowing, and then it can be discharged onto the grid when those aren't the case. Those certifications can be used to go through and literally say, okay, you've got all these secure components, you've done your testing. Now I've got this piece of paper. And if I change any component, I have to recertify. So that functions as your SBOM, that secure bill of materials, to say the things that are here should be okay the way they sit as of this date. Now, the secure update process, that's a whole separate thing. And you know, SolarWinds is probably the most famous of those, right, from that standpoint. But the risk here is in not understanding, if you're working with an integrator or you're working with a vendor that's sourcing components, make sure you know what components they're choosing. You know, famously, the U.S. government went through and said, okay, certain vendors aren't allowed, or you're not allowed to buy surveillance equipment. Video cameras, right? Hikvision was one of those. There are certain vendors you're not allowed to purchase and install within U.S. government facilities. And a lot of the private sector kind of followed suit on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Getting down that path and figuring out, okay, these are vendors that not necessarily are bad, but just haven't done their due diligence.
Right.
That potentially should be something that takes them off your list.
Right.
I was doing a penetration test for an energy utility in the Northeast years ago, and they had deployed smart meters. And the smart metering network, when it's deployed, this is 700,000 smart meters, more than half a state. When they deploy those networks, they have this huge mesh wireless network. Well, there's extra bandwidth in it. And so they said, we'd like to use this for recloser automation, which is basically turning on and shutting off parts of the power grid. You know, a tree line falls, you need to shut the power off to that section. They used to send a truck out to the substation and shut it off. But with recloser automation, they can do that all remote. They said, hey, we've got this network here. We just need a secure way to get the reclosers onto the network. We're going to buy these little security gateways and let them connect. Well, and this is a big piece of advice here. They could have bought two or three of them. This is the vendor that didn't do any security testing. They could have bought two or three of them and done their own security testing either internally or paid somebody to vet them. And they didn't. And so when I found a vulnerability in them that allowed me to get back into the power grid, they then had to go to the vendor, and the vendor said, you know, we don't do a lot of work in the space. We're not really concerned about patching that. They had to pick a new device and buy thousands of them and replace them all. Potentially multi-million dollar mistake, because it wasn't part of their programmatic approach to say, either we're going to buy a few and test them, or we're going to stand it up in a lab when that's all ready to go and do a complete end-to-end test before we turn it loose in the wild.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say maybe that device they picked had the lowest unit cost of the
that's my guess.
You know,
like, in fact, that vendor name stuck in my head, and it came up in a conversation with a client the other day, and I said, don't do that.
Yeah.
And I told them the story.
And there's nothing to compel them regulation-wise to say, you have to fix that. You can't.
No.
And it's like, well, we don't want to.
Under SIP 13,
organizations
working in the energy sector have to, but nothing would force a large manufacturer to do it. We're helping a large manufacturer, you know, 37 plants globally, go through and do their segmentation and put some security visibility tools in place. And we've now had that conversation with them. They're sticking with mostly primary vendor products from a couple of platforms that are known and tested and known good. But that due diligence is important. And one of the messages also is be friendly with your procurement people. Because if they understand some of the things you need, you might have to educate them. They're not, you know, in your space technically, but even if you give them a checklist or just give them a 20-minute, hey, this is what we do, this is how these things work, this is why this is important, that once again, you're personalizing that little bit of education so that in the back of their heads, when they're running your RFP, they know to add 5 or 6 more questions specifically to help get the information you need.
So, I mean, we're hearing a lot from the Biden administration, cyber executive order and stuff around things like software bills of material and just trying to quantify that ingredients list for hardware and software. And critical infrastructure is a big part of that executive order. Are you seeing that having any impact in terms of acquisition, you know, technology purchase, acquisition, so on, you know, critical infrastructure owners or their suppliers sort of pushing back and saying, we want to see the SBOM, you know, we want to be able to verify what's in it, that type of thing.
There is some knowledge and acceptance of that. And there's been a push. There's been a couple of very, very large companies that have said, not only are we going to do this in our critical infrastructure purchases, but we're going to do it IT-wide. And when you're a 10, 15, 20, 30,000 person company, that has a bigger impact. And so now you're putting on notice some of the big names, right? Some of the biggest software vendors, some of the biggest hardware vendors.
Yep.
That these are things that you're going to require, that you're going to make sure that the TPM chip that's in these laptops that I'm going to buy 5,000 of has been tested and you can show me a certification, or you can guarantee through some other mechanism, and the SBOM reflects that it's a secure module and it hasn't been tampered with and all that fun stuff.
And sometimes it takes out those very large vendors of very large customers to kind of set the yes. standard, and the downstream effects for smaller organizations is good, right? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, they can
ride. Companies will do it for the small companies.
Absolutely beneficial. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Final question. So if you were, you know, the OT czar, the critical infrastructure cyber czar, what would your approach be to addressing some of the risks that we've talked about, you know, these sophisticated actors, the kind of, you know, legacy investments and those types of risks? What do you think is the best approach to actually raise the bar on the security of OT and critical infrastructure?
So I see that as a three-pronged approach, really. The first is that most of the regulations have no teeth. So when organizations get found in violation of NERC SIP, they can face fines of $1 million per day per instance of noncompliance. Basically, none of the other regulations that have come out have that kind of a backbone to them for enforcement. So, you know, OUIA has been this sort of, it's in, it's out, we're going to enforce it, we're not. It's still, you know, there's basically a daily announcements with the EPA around that right now. And I know AWWA and the work we've been doing with them is really sort of still focused on that. There have been some things that have come out in the National Security Memorandum that were part of the National Cybersecurity Strategy, the Sector 5 entities really being pushed down that path. So the implementation of it is the important part, where the rubber meets the road. You can put anything you want out on paper. DHS has had guidelines for cybersecurity for, I think, 18 sectors for probably 15 or 20 years. But they were always sort of best effort, you do the best you can. And so the regulatory side, having some actual real financial burden for the organizations, or like what Sarbanes-Oxley did, where if you found to not be upholding your fiduciary responsibility, the CEO or the CFO gets in trouble. You know, that's part of it. And we've seen the SEC reporting guidelines for the publicly traded entities. The second one is that education piece that I've talked about a couple of times. And what gets to this point is there are not a lot of people that do this OT SCADA security work. And we're a smaller group and we kind of, a lot of us know each other. Offer free education or low cost education for these system owners and operators that are not in the energy sector, not in the water sector. You know, oil and gas, after the Colonial Pipeline attack, TSA came out with some regulation. Offer the education so they better understand what they should be doing and how to get there. And then the third thing is most of these organizations don't have enough money to do this. And so if you want to protect critical infrastructure here, the government may have to pony up some money. There was a bunch of grant money offered through ARRA in 2008.
Yeah.
It might be time for another era of some of that, because some of this infrastructure is so old that it's almost impossible to protect.
Yeah.
So, and the organizations that own it, if they're not big for-profit entities, they just may not have the funds, the resources.
I don't know, 16 years, you think?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the fourth piece, and it's kind of part of the education, is how do we grow the cyber workforce? I've been part of the Cyber Patriot organization for about 10 years. So that's the National Middle School and High School Cyber Defense Competition. Mm-hmm. And then the college version is CCDC. And this is one of our best opportunities for practitioners to get involved as mentors and really help grow the workforce. Yeah. So I coached the national championship team in 2016, and two members of that team work for us, right? They have followed along, they've gotten internships and mentorship and the ability to help grow. And then that team still exists and went back to national finals this year.
Yeah.
So this is our capability. That's the other way to plug the gap.
Such a huge opportunity. And I'm always surprised that we're not, you know, working it into technical education programs or really trying to get it down to the grassroots, you know, because it's sort of like, oh my God.
Stay tuned on that. I may be working on some things in the way to see what we can do. You know, there's a thought that the European model of apprenticeship really would be a good fit in certain parts of American culture. And this may be one of those.
I agree with you. Yeah. And when you're looking at like SOC operator and so, you know, the kind of entry level, like those are things that you absolutely could have as part of a, you know, 9 through 12
and Steve looking over the shoulder of somebody that knows what they're doing, you know, gaining responsibility over time.
Yeah.
And particularly when we're talking about, so our MSSP also functions in the OT SCADA, that sort of SCADA SOC space. You have to know that, okay, that's not a normal function in that space. This is not like IT where the systems are just going to tell you. And then you have to know, okay, I need to call the plant manager, or I need to escalate in our mm-hmm. case to somebody from the connected systems team who understands this stuff to help make the determination on whether or not it's really a problem.
Mm-hmm. This is a great conversation.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I enjoy these conversations. This is, I like talking about this stuff.
You're good at it, and you have interesting things to say. So I'm glad you enjoy it as well. Christopher Walcott, Chief Security Officer at Direct Defense. It's been great having you on the Security Ledger podcast. We will definitely have you on again. Look forward to seeing you in a few weeks out at RSA.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed this. Love to do it again.
Great. Absolutely. Take care, Chris.